Welcome to Building Remotely. In this podcast, we talk with founders and leaders in successful remote companies in order to find useful strategies that you can apply in your own. I'm your host, Sondre, the founder and CEO of SafetyWing, a Y Combinator-backed remote startup building the world's first country on the internet. Let's begin.
If you can get other people to invest into the community, other people to try to work to build it, then they feel personally invested. They want to see it succeed. They want to invite their friends. They want to keep building it. They turn from this passive member of the community into an ambassador.
In this episode, I'm joined by Spencer Gentsch. He is a former bat catcher, CEO of Hacker Paradise, and now co-founder of Vagabond Partners, as well as head of community at Schoolhouse. Welcome to the Building Remotely podcast, Spencer.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
So in this episode, me and Spencer want to explore the steps needed to build a remote community based on his experiences from Schoolhouse and Hacker Paradise, one of the biggest communities in the digital nomad world. Spencer, my first question is, were you able to catch any bats?
I caught a lot of bats. I used to work as a summer camp counselor, and there was bats that would break into the cabins. And so because there was risk of them having rabies and biting a child, whenever a bat would break in, they would call us and we'd have to run over and catch the bat. And they gave us about a 10-minute training on how to do it and gave us an ice cream bucket and a baseball mitt and told us that that's how we had to catch them. So I never got bit. None of our kids ever got bit. But there's some pretty funny stories about kids screaming as there's bats flying around their heads and then locking the bat in a closet and having to go in with no light and catch a bat as it's circling. So good memories.
I have to say, as I was researching this episode, you have a very fascinating life. I was also curious, you wrote your master thesis on language branding in North Korea. What is language branding?
Yeah, language branding is the concept that instead of language just changing on its own, that there's someone in charge trying to control the way a language is perceived or the way the language changes. And in the example of North Korea, it's definitely for political advantage. And lots of countries do this in different ways. But yeah, I studied a specific language magazine that would teach people words they should use or shouldn't use. And then also would say things like, when you're talking about the dictator, you need to speak slower, like this many words per minute to show your reverence. When you're talking about your father, you say this many words per minute to show your admiration. So there's lots of really interesting ways that they tried to prescribe how the language was used and how it was perceived.
And then you also taught Korean for 4 years. How did you get from that world of language to the tech world and digital nomad scene?
Yeah, I taught Korean for a while and I really enjoyed it. I really like teaching, which is one of the reasons I'm really excited to be back kind of in the education sphere with some of my current stuff that I'm doing. Teaching Korean was hard as a non-native speaker, and it was hard to like find jobs and convince people that I should be trusted as a non-native speaker. So yeah, I decided to try something different, went totally out of my field and went to do project management at a healthcare company that provided healthcare software. And that's where I fell in love with like operations, which is still a lot of the piece of what I do today with community work. But that's where I fell in love with operations and project management type stuff.
I see. So you've built two or have been responsible for two communities. It's the Schoolhouse one, which I understand is a teacher-students-based communities, and of course the one in Hacker Paradise. What's the difference between the two?
In terms of the people that make up the community and the type of community is, they're very different. Like same basic principles for community building apply, but as you said, Schoolhouse is a community that we have based for teachers who, instead of working at a traditional brick-and-mortar school, are distributed and teaching in people's homes to a couple of families in the neighborhood. So they don't have the same relationships with the teacher in a classroom next door that you would have at a traditional school. So there we're focusing a lot on building this professional network for teachers who just don't see each other as much as they used to. For Hacker Paradise, that's a totally different group. It's digital nomads who want to travel the world while working And for that, we were traveling and working and living together. I would see these people all the time when they were in on location with us. So there was a lot of in-person and online community building stuff. And you would, if you were with the group for 3 months, you would see these people every single day and spend most of the day with them, whether you were working alongside them or hanging out with them at night. So two very different types of customers and community members, and two very separate business models.
Mm. If you were to look back or look around, what were you most proud of achieving in each of them?
Yeah. So the Schoolhouse community and that work is still very new. So for us, we're just really excited to have established what we've done so far of setting up a new way of doing education that provides more value to the student. The teacher-student ratio is better. It helps value the teacher more. So we're really excited about the setup that we've done there and excited to see where it goes over the next months and years about where that community grows and turns into. For Hacker Paradise, I came on when the company was still very small and helped grow it into, I think, a stronger, more inclusive community that had people that just loved us and they're very loyal to us. And so that's what I'm most proud about, is the community that we grew there, that people found value in it. And we were able to do a lot of cool things, get a lot of work done while still having a lot of fun at the same time.
Yeah, that is definitely what you want to achieve. I mean, we are thinking a lot about community in Safety Wing. So I'm very curious to learn everything I can from you, really. To begin with the basics, and at least for my part, I do feel like I need to know the basics. So what is a community to you?
Yeah, community to me is a group that has some sort of common goal or some sort of common value, something that brings them together. A lot of times we see communities start small, they can grow, but even big communities are amalgamations of lots of smaller communities. Community building really happens on a person-to-person level. And as you bond and grow this community in small groups and then multiple small groups and then lots of small groups that kind of feed up into the greater group as a whole, I think that's where we see the most successful communities.
Mm. You know, as you're saying that, that is so interesting because I'm, you know, definitely pro individualism and, you know, do your own thing. But, you know, everyone, at least in digital nomad world, kind of recognizes that there is this loss of community or the need to rebuild new communities that comes with that.
Mm-hmm.
And just as you gave that answer, I just reflected that. I wonder if that's where it's at. It's kind of this loss of common, like, because when people think about it, they usually refer to hanging out with someone, not necessarily having someone with shared, you know, purpose and values.
Yeah. But why are you choosing to hang out with that person? Hopefully, it's because you have something in common or some common goal you're working towards. If not, then they're just like a filler. And I mean, it's weird to describe people as that, but there's times when, like, I'm traveling and I don't know anybody in town and someone will hang out with me and I'll hang out with them just because I need to hang out with people. I need some social interaction. But like, as you get to know them, it's like they're not my type of person. They're not who I would hang out with otherwise. But like, if I don't have a community where I am, you do the best you can.
All right. No, that makes a lot of sense. So how do you build a great community from scratch?
Yeah. So I think the big thing is making sure you understand what's valuable for the community. What is it providing? So the big question that I like to ask is, what are we accomplishing together that we can't do individually? That's the big reason that people are going to keep coming back to your community. That's why they want to be part of the community. If it's something they can do on their own and they get that same value on their own, why would they need to be part of this greater group? So it's really honing in on what's that thing we can accomplish together that we can't do individually.
Well, how do you recognize what is something? So I'm trying to imagine, like, what can I do on my own? I mean, quite a lot, but I guess, for example, if I'm building a house and I need someone to hold the other end of the, like, plank, how do you recognize what is the kind of things that you can do together and not apart?
Yeah. So a lot of people, when they think of communities, they think of, oh, I'm in this Facebook group and there's like chatter, there's people talking. And I think that's a very basic level of community. I think community a lot of times is stuff that you create or grow together. For example, when we were building Hacker Paradise, the initial need that people came to us was, I don't want to travel alone. And so I want to be part of this community in this group so that I have a group that I can be with. I won't be alone. That's the initial thing that people came for, like an initial need. And we continued to build and grow on that. And so the overall goal of the community was to provide this international network of friends, colleagues, other professionals who were also traveling and working that you could travel and work with. Because we have people that would say, oh, I'm traveling for work, but I'm traveling with my friends who aren't working. And every day they're trying to make me go to the beach or go hiking. And it's really difficult to work because they're not working. So we had this unique place where we were helping provide value of giving people a community on the road that they could travel with of other business professionals.
I see. Now, that is definitely something you can't do on your own. So let's say that you had an idea or someone had an idea for a purpose that they couldn't do on their own. How do you start?
Yeah. So you define those purposes and then you got to find the right people that are interested and the people that will help build the community. And that can be really challenging at first about finding the people and then getting them to help build it. So there's a common misconception that people have that if I am the community manager, if I do all the work, everybody will love me, I'll be respected, everybody will appreciate me. Mm-hmm. And the opposite is actually true, where if you can get other people to invest into the community, other people to try to work to build it, then they feel personally invested, they want to see it succeed, they want to invite their friends, they want to keep building it. They turn from this passive member of the community into an ambassador where they're going and talking about you. And so from that regard, when you're starting to build a community, it's really important to say, okay, how do we take these people that we've found who are interested, but who are passive observers, and how do we turn them into these ambassadors or leaders in the community? And then you kind of map out what type of steps they might need to take to make it there and what type of things you can provide, what structure or opportunities you can provide as a community manager to help them grow and move in that direction. Now, if you've gotten lots of people to move that way, not everyone in your community is always going to become an ambassador. But if you keep moving people to be more committed and moving in that direction, not only is your community stronger, even though you might be doing less of like the day-to-day stuff, your community is stronger and your reach is so much further because there's only so much I can do on my own. But once I have a strong community and there's 15 other people that believe in the same thing and are willing to contribute, then they're going out and helping bring more people into the community as well. So from like a community standpoint, it not only makes your community stronger, but it increases your reach and your growth.
Oh, that is such a brilliant insight. I noticed that. I mean, I just actually just talked about this, but when I got married, we were kind of pulling this a bit off spontaneously because of COVID, very small one. And we kind of had a week to do it all. So every guest in the wedding had a task and everyone reflected on that after we heard that. That was one of the things they enjoyed the most because everyone was kind of hosting the wedding.
Yeah, there's a philosophy I heard once too about like you feel more committed to the city that you live in if you feel like it's unfinished.
Yeah.
That's one of the reasons I think lots of people love living in Berlin is they feel like it's an unfinished city where they can help build and invest in growing the city and making it a better place.
Yeah.
Where cities where it just feels like it's been done and there's nothing for me to help with it growing or building, you feel less connected to as a person, as a citizen.
Yeah. Wow, that is so true. And I also love living in Berlin. And you're right, it does feel very unfinished. It's like there's room to build it here.
Mm-hmm.
It's, you know, slightly less comfortable perhaps than living in a finished city, but so much more meaningful. Building remotely, what is the main challenges and advantages of building a community online?
Yeah, there's a lot of challenges for building community online, for me, with my experience, I've had like both sides of that. So growing a remote company that I was in charge of, and then also growing this community of other people as well that weren't necessarily part of my company structure. So I think there's challenges on both sides, and some of them overlap and some of them don't. For one, I think one of the really big ones is making sure that you still have opportunities to build relationships with people. When you're building an online community, the like very low level approach that lots of people think of as building community is just like posting on social media and maybe responding to some comments, which is like really low lift. I think past that, there's a lot more steps that you can do to really build personal relationships with people. When I think about it in terms of the community for the company I ran, we tried to make sure that we had lots of opportunities to have regular FaceTime, even though we are fully remote and there's some of my employees I never met face-to-face physically in person after working with them for years. So we have like regular touch bases. The one thing I always say to people is turn on your video. Like if you're on a Zoom call, you should turn on your video and be able to connect with someone by seeing them. Like that makes such a difference with how you connect with people. Even trying to make things like Donut Buddy is a popular app people will use in Slack to connect people for one-on-one chats every week. Making sure you have connections, maybe even like a happy hour where people can connect in ways that are meaningful, more than just 20 people in one Zoom room with one person dominating the conversation. Like there's better, smarter ways to do that.
Could I ask you, what are some better ways to do that?
Yeah. So there's always ways, kind of like I said before, to break it down into smaller groups. 20 people on a Zoom call over an hour, it means that you're going to get less than 2 minutes of saying something, right? You're not going to get a whole lot of time. And so there's always ways to do smaller breakout room type things. There's other platforms like Icebreaker.video is one that does small speed dating events where you can split people up. I've done one before where we all participated in an online magic show, which was kind of cool. Or I've seen ones where you can hire a drag queen to come and teach you guys a dance routine over Zoom video. Like there's things that are like more involved than just sitting with a drink in your hand waiting for your turn to speak.
Yeah, I've tried Icebreaker. Highly recommend that to anyone listening. That is a great app. And we also use Sococo, which also is like Tandem, Roam, or others, great products for that, which is also good for those breakout rooms.
Yeah.
So in building these communities, what's something that was way harder than you expected it to be?
For me, one thing I wasn't expecting was how difficult scaling it would be. So if I think about it from both my own company perspective and then from the online community, as you grow, things change naturally. And it's really difficult when you're first getting your hands around it to understand how much it changes. For Hacker Paradise, when I started, it was about 2-3 people. And then we grew it to about 15-20 people by the time I left. And when you just look at the numbers, you think that's not very much. We just added a couple more people. But that's like timesing the company, you know, 5 times as much as the size was before. And if you think about communication pathway theory, if you have 3 people, there's really only 3 communication pathways, like person A to person B, person B to person C, and person A to person C. There's only 3 ways of channels of communication. And then as soon as you have 15 people, there's over 100 because it just is so much more complex. So even basic things like making sure your communication is under control is clear is something that I was not prepared for and had to learn as we were growing. So the big thing that I learned that I would tell people is establish early on official channels of communication. So making sure that you have documentation, and we had like an all hands meeting, which was the official place where I would put out announcements every month. We had a couple channels in Slack where like these were the official announcement channels, you know, like even if you're hearing other things from some of your other friends for the company, it's not official until it's like in this forum. Even things like we had a weekly stand-up channel where people would post what they were going to do and what they did. So like on an individual level, you knew what was going on with people. One side note about that too, that I think is really interesting. We didn't have a lot of participation on that to begin with. Like people didn't like posting what they're doing for work. I don't know why. I guess it's not very exciting. It's like lowest of your priorities. But what we started doing is we started telling people to include a personal update in that every week. So you do like what you're doing for work and then like what happened over the weekend personally, or like anything personal you wanted to include. It became our most popular channel. Because even if, you know, what I'm doing for work is kind of boring, whatever, I can do the personal update below and tell like the funny, crazy story that happened over the weekend. And then everybody commenting on it and wants to like know more or wants to know this or that. And it really, really changed the dynamic of our team and like our personal updates by making sure to include some of that stuff that helps you connect to people.
Okay, that's a great idea. I'm going to borrow that one. Is there some kind of community that kind of has to be a certain size? Where you talked about the importance of the right size in order to build strong relationships, and it kind of relates to what you were saying here. How do you know what's the right size?
Yeah, that's a great question. It really is going to depend on the type of community you have and what your goals are and what that pathway is for how people grow. They do say that once you're hitting over like 40, 50 people, you start to feel like the group is bigger than the individual. So you kind of start to fade into the background as opposed to an active participant. So that doesn't mean that you can't have communities over that amount, but that's especially where the smaller group structure comes into play. You still have to feel engaged in some sort of smaller community that then feeds up into the overall community and the goals of that.
Yeah.
So having that structure in play, I think, is really important. The other thing that we had happen with Hacker Paradise, which was really interesting and I wasn't really ready for, was the theory of group dilution. So at the beginning, when you're a smaller group, you maybe have a more concise and narrow identity that's easier for people to identify with that group and know what their place is inside of it. But as the group grows and different groups and types of people with different ideas and life experiences like come into the group, that can dilute some of that group identity. And for some people, that can be like a negative, jarring experience, as then they don't know what their role is inside. So in those cases, I still don't think there's a cap on like how big the group should be. You can feel free to grow your group as big as you can, as long as you have small subgroups. But it's important to go back to the original point of figuring out what defines us as a community.
Yeah.
Were other things that we thought defined us as a community that were now challenging as we grow bigger, but just understanding what is the number one thing that makes this group exist that you're providing to this community that you can provide as a group that you can't provide as an individual. So making sure that is really clear as you continue to grow, I think will combat the challenges that naturally arise with the group growing bigger than it originally was.
Yeah, fascinating. Yeah, that also relates to this idea I remember I heard long ago about, I think it was called Eternal September, where AOL or some of the early internet, I think it was AOL, had these chat rooms. And every September, there would come like a new batch of people online. And they had this kind of vibrant culture in the chat boards. But then they switched the rule and suddenly they were kind of getting people on fluently, kind of flowing. And then the whole culture was diluted because of all these newcomers who weren't with the program and they weren't able to keep up. And that kind of community fell apart.
Yeah. I mean, I think naturally, culture and community will tend to chaos if not managed. Like, it's an interesting concept to talk about, but naturally they'll go a bit chaotic. So it definitely needs someone who's in charge of managing both the culture and the community to make sure that it stays in line with what makes sense for your brand or your group. And that takes work. Lots of people think it just happens naturally, but it definitely takes ideas, planning, attention. It takes a lot of work to make it happen correctly.
Yeah. So when choosing this purpose for a community, what are some keys to kind of return to that towards the end? What are some keys to choosing a purpose that's going to make a thriving community, you think?
I mean, that's the million-dollar question, right? Is how do we define what like our mission is? What's our vision? What like makes sense for us? So there's a lot of different types of activities you can go through that help you identify what that might be for you as an individual or together as a group. One of the ones I've really liked to do with groups I've worked with is the peaks and valley activity. I don't know if you've heard of it before, but basically you map out whether it's your experience in life or your experience at the company or your experience with this community. Mm. And you say, if someone's writing a documentary or a memoir about me, and they're going to pinpoint these like 10 most influential parts in my life, what are they? And you put them on a timeline, and then you talk about what's like the happiest moments and what's the least happy moments. Mm. And what characterized those in your experience. And at least when I did this with a lot of groups, the thing that came back to me really often is that people always seem to be the most happiest in their life when there was a strong sense of belonging. Mm. And that means different things to different people. But that's the number one reason why when people seem to feel happy or when they really felt part of a community. So that type of exercise really helped us as we were structuring our Hacker Paradise community. Mm. How do we structure these things to try to align all the stuff that we're providing with these values of what people have and what we can provide as a community? Mm. So I think that type of exercise can be really helpful for people. I think there's other exercises too, just to go through and sit down what type of mission or values that you would have as a community as well.
Mm. And I suppose that is related to what do people want from a community? How do you make sure that on a daily or weekly basis, it's worth coming back to and engage with over and over again?
Yeah. So for me, it comes back to that sense of belonging. I think that's where people really get value from. And similar to what we've discussed earlier, a lot of that is coming from them investing in the community. So even mm-hmm. with like online Facebook groups, which are some types of communities I've helped run before, the people who post are the people who also answer other people's questions on their post, who also will invite their friends to the community.
I see.
The people who actually make an effort and contribute are the people who continue to contribute in all the areas across the board.
Mm. And you give people, you know, what tasks, mandates, responsibilities to give them kind of a feeling that they can contribute? Is that it?
Yeah, I would give them opportunities. So if you can create opportunities for them to contribute, it makes it easier for them. It lowers the barrier of entry. So for a person in some sort of online community, it can be intimidating to make a first post because you don't know mm-hmm. who anybody is, whatever. But if you have, say, an introductions channel and you say, hey, you're new here, please introduce yourself in the introductions channel, that's an easy ask. Like everybody knows everyone in that channel is new. So like you're not going to be weird and posting and no one knows who you are. And then people comment on that and you start to feel more comfortable. Or you can post other types of posts that ask a question and then people can comment. You're inviting people to be active. So even with fully online communities on, say, a Facebook group or an Instagram group, which are, you know, different types of communities than, say, a Hacker Paradise community, but even with those, there's ways where you can invite people to contribute in ways that make them feel less pressure and make them more willing to grow in that way that you're hoping they grow in.
Mm. Okay. One more one on belonging. So I'm trying to imagine what communities I feel belonging. I mean, I do with Safe Doing, and we have some fun things that I think create a little bit of belonging. One thing we made for fun was everyone gets this bird illustration of themselves as a bird.
Nice.
And everyone uses that as a profile photo. It's very silly, but it's kind of so silly that it creates a little bit of belonging.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have some better examples, perhaps, of what are some things that create belonging?
I wish I had a picture of me as a bird. I think that's what I'm going to request after this podcast. I think the more specific it is to your group, the more it has value. So for you guys, because you're Safety Wings, doing something as a bird is like cute and interesting and unique. And so it makes sense to people. I don't have like $1 million idea off the top of my head of what makes this so great or like that will make sense to every group. But I think just understanding your group and like what their drivers are and then do some sort of personalized touch with that makes sense. Whatever it is, I think it should be something that's a bit personalized.
And lastly, how do you know if your community is successful or maybe if it needs work, like if the forces of chaos have the upper hand? Are there any metrics you look at or red flags, green flags?
Yeah, every community needs work or else it will go to chaos. So that everyone needs to be monitoring their community because it can change from day to day. In terms of metrics, lots of people who aren't in the community sphere will think that community is just really touchy-feely. It's just someone's gut. And there is some gut to it, sure, but there's also metrics and data to back it up. And there's research saying that, hey, having a strong, successful community is what's really going to drive your brand loyalty and your sales in our current environment. So it's really important for people to get right and build. Since it does impact so much about brand loyalty and sales and growth, you can see community in all of those pieces. So for example, if your community is going well, your sales should also be going the right direction. So there's a lot of metrics where community plays a role, but there are specific metrics you can look at specific to community. Those will depend on what your pathway is for how you want your community to grow. So if you're an online community and for you, you want to turn people into ambassadors that recommend your Facebook group, you know, you could start monitoring not just how many people are in the group and how often people are on posts, but how often people are recommending it to other people or inviting people. Whatever are these steps that you're creating for people to take, you can monitor all of those.
That is really a good full step plan we have there. So I'm mindful that we're coming up on the hour. I learned so much from this conversation, and I really hope to be able to have another conversation in the future. Thanks a lot for joining. Where can people who want to read more about your writings or your projects, where can they find more?
That's a great question. I don't have a great place that I post things anymore, but if people want to get a hold of me to ask questions or whatever, they can email me at spencergench@gmail.com. At these points, I'm just doing my musings on podcasts like this. I don't have a central blog for my own self.
All right. So if anyone has any questions about wild bat catching or North Korean language branding, you can email Spencer there. We'll put that in the description. Spencer, thanks again. This has been great.
Thank you very much. I'll be waiting for my personalized bird drawing.
Thanks for listening. To further explore what we discussed in this episode, go to buildingremotely.com, where you can read an article that goes deeper. If you have ideas for this podcast, please email us at podcast@buildingremotely.com, and we can address it in a future episode of Building Remotely.